You're listening to the weekly Portland podcast. For a complete list of episodes, visit pdxpod.com or find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Remember to like, share, and subscribe.
Comedian Katie Nye can be seen regularly as a co-host at the Portland Comedy Showcase Earthquake Hurricane. A language arts educator by day, Katie's opened for national acts, including Matt Bronger and Ron Funches. I'm Gregory Day with the Weekly Portland Podcast. Happy New Year. Katie's a busy lady with plenty of new shows on the horizon for 2018. Make sure to peruse her website for the latest. We're going to be listening to some clips of Katie's performances at Curious Comedy and Backfence PDX today and learn a bit more about Katie's background. Without further ado, let's meet our special guest today and the first of the new year, Katie Nye at the Nines Hotel.
My parents are immigrants from Vietnam. They're from like a relatively traditional kind of culture. They don't really drink a lot. They're not morally against drinking or swearing or that kind of thing. It just doesn't come up. I didn't grow up. My parents don't really swear. They don't really, you know, it wasn't like, you know, that uncle who's always making dirty jokes. Like, that was not a thing at our house.
Hello, how are you all? Good, that's important to me. I heard these two pop songs on the radio recently, and I found the lyrics interesting in the exact same way. And this first song is by this woman. I don't know who sings it, but she's this woman. She's repeating over and over again. She's singing. She's going, I'm a cool girl. I'm a cool girl. I was like, sure. Sure. It's a good song. But then I heard this other song by Rihanna that got really famous. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's just Rihanna, and she's repeating over and over again. She's singing. She's going, sex with me is so amazing. And I was like, I didn't know we could do that. I didn't realize we could just write and sing songs just of what we want other people to think about us and make like a ton of money off of it. And I've been giving a lot of thought and I developed some new career goals. And I put a lot of work into it, and I've written a bunch of songs. I think I might actually be kind of good at this. Actually, a few songs I'd like to share with you tonight, if that's cool. Thanks. I just really need like 100% honest feedback, because I really think this could be like a new path for me. So this first song I wrote, it goes like this. Look at me, I'm 6 feet tall. Look at me, I'm 6 feet tall. Look at me, I can see the top of the fridge. I totally know what's up there. Dude, it's much stuff, I can see it.
First of all, I didn't plan on becoming a performer at all. That was not my end goal. That was not something I was pursuing professionally on any level. I moved here and I had a corporate job in a cubicle.
When was this?
February 2011.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anybody here. I moved out here just kind of on a, you know, just not on a whim, but it was kind of like...
It wasn't Minnesota.
Yeah. It was very different from Minnesota, and I'd never been here before I moved here, before my interview. When I get drunk, it comes out, and then
people
make fun of me. Yeah, my Minnesotan accent. That's my go-to accent, too, the Minnesotan mom accent. You know, I've heard it so many times. You know, it makes you think of Bobby's World. You ever see Bobby's World? Howie Mandel's cartoon show? it's a very Minnesota thing, Bobby's World. Life with Louis Anderson is a gem. But, I moved out here. I didn't know anything.
2011.
Mm-hmm.
You're in your cubicle. You're thinking, oh, I really should do something else.
Yeah, I was thinking I need to do something with my time. Because it was the first time, it was right after I finished, a little while after I'd finished college. So the first time in in a while that I never had, like, homework to take home. Like, even with my job now, if I go home, even if I've finished my work for the day, there's always something else I could do. I can always improve a lesson. I can always, you know, make another version of a worksheet for kids who learn differently. There's always something you can do to improve it. At the time, I was working this kind of dead-end job that required very little of me, and I just had no intellectual stimulation whatsoever. At one point, I decided to take classes just for brain exercise, improv classes, stand-up classes. I didn't plan on being a performer. I had no desire to perform.
Were at a community college or just local?
Brody Theater, right here.
Oh, at the Brody.
Yeah, yeah. At, like, Broadway and Burnside here. And I just signed up just to exercise my brain. Like I said, it really wasn't a desire for attention. I kind of avoided it for a while. And they just went really well for me, and they felt good, and I got good positive feedback, and I was really enjoying the people I was around, the task, like the types of tasks you need to complete in order to develop those skills.
Still going strong.
Yeah, yeah, they're doing great.
And you did that for years?
Before I started getting booked.
Yes.
Not that long. It was probably within a year. I started really strong because for the 10 years preceding, I wrote a blog. That was just kind of my creative pursuit from when I was like 14 to college, and it started off kind of like a daily. And it was never a personal journal. It was just like talking about my day, and then that slowly morphed into specifically talking about things I found entertaining or funny or thoughts that occurred to me throughout the day or just going off. Not
rants. What was this blog called?
Peanut Planet.
Peanut Planet.
Yeah. All the screen names and websites and emails I had all my life have to do with food. Yeah. My AOL screen name was Butter My Fancy. My email was Lemon Tea Cake. My blog was Peanut Planet. That was just my thing. Kids. I actually have another song. I know, I'm like a factory. And this song's actually really personal, so it's really important to me, and I hope you guys like it. It goes like this. I totally don't still think about that time in fifth grade when my crush Ben Grady said I had a mustache. I totally don't still think about that time. My crush Grady said. That song's called Fuck You, Ben Grady. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, I'm really bad at PR. I don't promote myself very well.
Under the radar?
Yeah. I'm definitely an alt comic, and I'm niche, and I'm one of the few ones who's also very dedicated to their day job. I don't get out as much as comics who have kind of shaped their life around comedy, you know? So people who have, like, graduate degrees, four-year degrees, lots of, like amazing work experience, but who choose to work in the service industry because it will help them in comedy, you know, and if that's their main focus, they're not necessarily, and I'm dedicating myself to my day job as well, and I went back to school for it a couple years ago, and I give it my all. So, you know, I work a lot of long days, I stress out about it, and a lot of comics aren't at that kind of place in their career, or that's not something that they want. The skills are so transferable between stand-up comedy and teaching. It's amazing. Teaching is essentially planting yourself in front of a bunch of people and trying to engage them and impart information and get them to buy in. You know? It's like the same thing. It's the same thing. And it's so funny because teachers are like, I don't know how you do comedy. I'm like, I am more nervous every morning before I start a class than I am before any show because the stakes feel higher to me. Something else kind of personal about me is the fact that I am a very, very sweaty and oily person. Yeah, yeah. And I spend a lot of time and energy trying to not look so sweaty and oily. Okay, a lot. But you know how the media just wants to make you want what you don't have, you know? Like if you have curly hair, you want straight hair. If you have one skin tone, you know their skin tone.
Well, I found out that there's this look being marketed by cosmetics companies, and you may have seen this, and it's called looking dewy. Have you seen this? Yeah, it's a thing. If you don't know what looking dewy is essentially looking kind of sweaty and oily. Yeah. Which is great for me. But it just got me thinking, though, you know, because there's a lot of beauty standards that I think I understand, you know, and the implications they might have if you see them. For example, if a woman's wearing high heels, her legs will look elongated. You might be like, oh, maybe she's like a dancer or something. You know, and she's like really flexible. You know, like in bed. Or if she's got like the smoky eye look going on, you might be like, oh, maybe she's like exotic or something. She's like extra sensual. You know, like in bed. But if she's looking dewy, it's gotta be like, oh, maybe she like passed out on the lawn last night. In bed.
At Earthquake Hurricane, you know, some shows like really pride themselves on bringing in new up-and-comers and like kind of taking a risk on people. One of the things we're really proud of is that we set the bar really high, and nobody we have questions yes. about we book. We only book people that we know are going to be funny, people we know who aren't going to offend the audience, you know, for a cheap laugh, people we know who aren't going to use it like they aren't going to treat it like an open mic. They're going to, you know, do some of like their better material for the show. And the better I got, the more I got booked on the show, and the more I got to know the other hosts, the more we spent time together. And when you spend time with comics, you're riffing. That's basically it. And everybody, whether or not they admit it, they're all trying to be funny to each other, because the people you want to impress as a comic are other comics. And then I started guest hosting just, you know, every once in a while, because with four hosts who are all performing a lot, you know, people are gone and they need subs. And I was doing that, and it felt really good, and the vibe felt really good, and Curtis Cook had moved, and they didn't rush to replace him. It was like a few months, but then once they realized that, you know, I fit what they were looking for, and I was super excited to do the show every time, they invited me to join, and it was just an obvious decision.
The crying. Let's talk about the crying.
Yes.
Where does this come from? What's the inspiration?
I'm very expressive. I use my face and my body a lot in comedy in a way that people don't. And I think when you are so exaggerated, it really gives people permission to laugh at sadness. You know, because if I just went up there and talked about how I have low self-esteem, you need to be pretty clever about it. But if I'm just going to go all out and just start sobbing, you know, people... And with self-deprecating jokes, sometimes people wonder, I think inside they think, oh, should I laugh at this? Like, it sounds like they're actually kind of sad about how they look. Or it sounds like they actually might actually be depressed about their dating situation. Or like, oh, that family sounds almost borderline abusive. But if I just, you know, put on an ugly cry face and I make myself real vulnerable in a way that is comical and exaggerated, I think people just get into it. And they really enjoy seeing that kind of like obviously fake suffering.
There's this other newer beauty standard that I'm sure you've heard of. It's very famous by now. It's called the thigh gap. Have you heard of this? The thigh gap? Yeah. It's got its own Wikipedia page. If you don't know what the thigh gap is, it's basically like if you put your feet together and you have a hole right here, that's supposed to be really pretty. You got a hole right there, that's the prettiest spot for a hole. You got a hole there, you're hot. Them's the rules. It's got to be right there. Yeah, I don't make the rules. I like how I look. I don't have a thigh gap, but I do have several mysterious dents in my skull. That's kind of like the same thing, right? Just missing flesh where there normally is some.
My strengths as a stand-up is my acting, and I act in every single bit that I do. From deadpan is acting, because if you're talking about something absurd and you maintain a really straight face, that's acting. Or if you're talking about something nuts, you know, then that's acting as well. And I think a lot of stand-ups, and I did this at the beginning of my career, I didn't do any act outs whatsoever. Now I'm known for my deadpan and act outs. Like, those are like kind of my characteristic bits. But at the beginning, I didn't do any act outs whatsoever. And I had this weird idea in my
head. Act outs, can you elaborate on that?
So
it's kind of inside baseball talk.
Yeah. So act outs is when you really just kind of go with the joke and you get into character, very strong into character. And I'm no longer describing what happened, describing what I felt. I am in that moment. I'm presenting to you how I felt in that moment. So I didn't do any of those at first because I had this weird idea in my head that if I had a persona of sorts, the audience appreciates it when you make yourself look less desirable. Because, you know, then it's not a vanity thing.
I think it was Woody Allen that said that people laugh at the character. It's not just the joke, but you're laughing at the character,
mm-hmm.
who that person is.
Yeah, there's characters are only accessible when there's something true in them to us. Like, if you present something, so even if I am not a quote-unquote kind of meathead character, if you present someone like that, a character who is obsessed with how muscular they are and, like, don't value, you know, intellectual discourse or something like that, everybody knows someone who's like that. And that's why it's so funny, because, like, oh, that makes you think of that person. Or at the very least, you're like, oh, yeah, that's familiar to me. And the characters are so powerful because we can tap into people's previous life experience and their knowledge base in order to present maybe new information or a new joke, but we use what they already know as a point of entry, which is what I think character work can often be. So a woman who works with Backfence, Frame Masters, also works with lo-fi, and I don't quite know everything that they get into.
Right, it's sort of a side project that they do. Mindy okay. Netafee also, they work in tandem,
okay.
and I think they've done work with The Moth, too. Live
yeah.
storytelling is huge in this city.
It's great. It's almost like reviving a tradition that we just kind of eschewed for the longest time, and now we're getting back into it, you know, kind of with print books. People are still into print books.
And now we're going to listen to Katie's presentation at Backfence PDX at the Alberta Rose Theatre.
So the first time I had surgery, I was 17 years old, and my dentist told me that I needed to have my wisdom teeth removed. And I actually only had two wisdom teeth. Most people have four. I just had two. Only two came in. Teenage me liked to think that that meant I was a little more evolved than my peers. As an adult, I think maybe I did not get enough calcium as a child. Legit concern. And I remember before the day, I was a little nervous about it, and my brother was talking to me about it, and he had gotten his wisdom teeth taken out the year before, and he had some advice for me. And he said, hey, when you go and you get your wisdom teeth out, ask him if you can keep him. Because he didn't get to keep his, right? And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, right? Like, why wouldn't you want to keep that? Like, it's part of you, right? Like, you only get in this lifetime 52 of them. And, yeah, 52. And if you're lucky, if everything goes ideally, you get, like, 20 of them, right? So you got to hold on to those. Because who wants a necklace with, like, only six teeth on it? So I filed that away. And so, like, with that in mind, I was almost looking forward to it. I was nervous. It was the first time I'd ever undergo surgery, the first time I'd ever get put under. But also, it had gone really smoothly for my brother, so I wasn't that wasn't that nervous. So the day arrived, my mom took me there, she drove me there. We went inside, and like the whole surgical team happened to be all women, which was like kind of cool. I didn't super register at the time, but I would be very thankful later. Yeah, and I got there, and they made me really comfortable. They were very kind and welcoming. And when I got in the chair, the surgeon explained to me what they were going to do. And because my wisdom teeth were impacted, I mean, they hadn't come out yet, it meant that they were going to cut open my gums, they were going to smash the teeth inside, and they were going to rip them out. You know, the classic cut, smash, smash, rip, rip. Yeah. It's also known as a CCSSRR. It was good to have the explanation, though. I was glad to understand it. So then they started to put me under, right? And in that process, they do like an IV first and then a gas. I don't know if you've ever been put under. And the IV doesn't knock you out, but it makes you kind of loopy, and then the gas is what knocks you out. So they put the IV in me, and I started to feel it a little bit, not super aware of it, but like you could tell what's happening. And all of a sudden, I remembered to ask the question to the lady, and I was like, I looked at her and I smiled and I was like, can I keep them? And she didn't know what I was talking about. Like, I was loopy, right? And she was like, keep what, honey? And I rolled my head and I looked at her and I go, you know. And she laughed at me, like you're all laughing at me. And then she put the mask on my face. And she was like, count backwards from 10. And I was like, 10, 9, 8. And it went fine, and it went great. And I didn't wake up during it, and I didn't feel a thing during it. But I did wake up gagging, yeah. And I said that deliberately. I didn't wake up and start gagging. I was not gagging before I woke up. As far as I know, I was unconscious. But when I woke up, I was gagging. And it felt very violent. Immediately, the ladies like were kind of concerned, right? And so they put what looked like a hospital bedpan on my chest in front of my face because I thought I was going to barf. And I wasn't barfing because I did a really good job fasting. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't barfing, but like I had this bedpan in front of my face, and that was not helping. That seems kind of like an anti-solution to the matter. And at this point, I'm just like gagging, and I must have just responded poorly to the anesthetic. Also, my mouth is full of gauze and blood. So I'm just like this teenage girl, just like gagging my guts out, and these women, they're starting to seem like very alarmed, right? And they're talking over me, and I'm just like gagging, and they're like, they make a decision, and one of them says to me, she's like, Katie, we're gonna give you a shot in your butt. And I was like, and then she repeated herself. She's like, we're gonna give you a shot in your butt. And I was like,
Joanne Chandelier, great comic. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on Joanne?
I really appreciate all. She's put a lot into the Portland scene, and she's invested a lot of time and energy not only in her own act but also to produce shows. That's really huge. That's a huge deal. And before I was on Earthquake Hurricane, I always kind of felt a little bit like a leech. That's why I always volunteered a lot of my time during Bridgetown Comedy Festival, because I wasn't producing shows before that. I wasn't hosting mics before that. And we need those people to do those things.
We do. They're a vessel for comics to work their material.
Mm-hmm. And they can be very thankless at times. You know, comics can be really hard to wrangle because they have such different lifestyles and jobs. And some people see it as a career. Some people see it as a hobby. So you never know how dedicated people are going to be. And if you don't have a guaranteed paycheck for them, you know, people aren't as invested as they might be, you know, showing up to their job. So Joanne's put a lot of work and energy into producing a very consistent
and
weekly show.
And it's a great podcast, too.
Yeah. She started, it's was that a year ago podcast. She started podcasting it? That was like a more recent thing. And she's very consistent with it. And she's also, you know, submitted to festivals. She's really invested a lot into her show. And that show provides stage time, both as a mic, they have a mic after the show, and as a showcase for local comics, and that's really invaluable, providing consistent stage time in a place that the venue wants comedy there, and that has consistent crowds, and I really appreciate that she put that into it. She doesn't... Okay, so certain women comics don't want to talk about any kind of women-specific material because so many people classify us that way. You know, South Park did a whole episode where they were making fun of Amy Schumer, and Cartman says, "Women are funny. Tell that joke about your vagina." And, like, you know, and because of that, because we see that, you know, a lot of times I... And not because of that, but I don't talk about, like, my period in general or things like that. But a lot of women might avoid talking about things that might otherwise be, like, a really great joke for them because they don't want to be, you know, typecast. They don't want to be pigeonholed. And enough people in society find those things objectionable. Like, oh, you know, they wouldn't think twice about a masturbation joke or a poop joke even. But, like, if it's a period joke, for some reason, society has made it. So that seems grosser to a lot of us. And I think Joanne has really not... You can see in her material that she's not worried about being labeled a woman comic. Because there's nothing... I mean, obviously, that's not offensive at all to be a woman comic. But knowing that enough people in the industry and in the world do find that offensive in and of itself, you know, can be discouraging for some people. And I don't think she's really let that inform her material in any way. And that's not all she talks about. But the fact that she's not afraid to talk about that, I can appreciate.
And then they undid the button on the fly of my jeans, and they pulled my pants down about here, and then they just gave me a shot right in the ass. And it hurt. It hurt so much more than what was going on in my mouth. And it felt like someone had, like, shoved, like, a broadsword. In my ass. Like, in my tender 17-year-old gagging ass, and, like, injected it with, like, acid or something into my flesh. And it really, really hurt, but it worked, and I stopped gagging. So they, like, wheeled me off to another room to take a nap on a cot, and when I woke up, everything seemed fine. They rolled me to my mom's car. She drove me home. On the way home, I started gagging again. And this time I actually almost like felt like I was starting to barf a little bit, except I did it into a plastic bag because I had the wherewithal to do it, and I am a considerate barfer. So that was just another thing. I'm like, oh, the anesthesia, I'm just, you know, reacting really poorly. And I get home, and I'm just so relieved to be home and finally be able to take a rest. And I kind of, you know, like, slowly, like, slog upstairs, and I flop onto my bed, and I try to fall asleep. But I soon realize that although my family almost never, ever has work done on the house, they're not a keeping up with the Jones kind of thing, that day there were roofers there at the house. And the way the my house is, at my parents' house, my room is on the second floor in the back left corner. And it just so happened that on that day, the roofers needed to hammer the shit out of the back left corner of the roof of our house. Very unfortunate. So that was going on, and I was just like, oh my God, really? But luckily, I was so dead tired, and the anesthesia was just barely wearing off, and my ass hurt so much. But luckily, I had a prescription for painkillers from the doctor. Yep, that's right. I got myself a nice little RX for some 800 milligram ibuprofen. Yeah. That hard shit. Yeah, don't fuck with that. So I had some of that, and I was able to sleep, thankfully. And the next few days were actually all right. The ibuprofen was really intense, but it helped with the pain, and I just had a little bit of nausea throughout. And then a couple days later, I was scheduled to go into work. I worked at the Orange Julius Dairy Queen in the mall food court. That was just a fact for my life. So I went in. Before I went in, I was like, feeling rough, but I can power through this. So I go in, and the second I get there, I realize, like, this is just not good. This is not, it did not feel well at all, but I didn't want to leave because given the circumstances at the time, if I did that, I would end up kind of just screwing over my coworkers. And it was like my brother and my really nice manager, Cheryl. So I was really trying to tough it out. So I was just there, just making and serving tons of smoothies and blizzards, just reeling with nausea. And it was just awful, and I just like could barely think, and just like the smell of all, it was so sweet and overwhelming, and I just like started to look like death, and I would not go home. And my manager Cheryl, she felt really bad at one point, so she offered me like a banana. I just was barely functioning, so I took it from her, and I remember I just kind of peeled it, and I took a bite, and I just held it in my mouth. And started crying. Not a high point. So they forced me to leave, obviously. That does not sell blizzards, apparently. Now I know. So they sent me home. My mom came and got me. She took me to the doctor and explained the situation. It was still, my wounds were still fresh. Like I was still probably in a lot of pain if I weren't taking the ibuprofen. And the doctor, after hearing the story, decided to not change my painkiller prescription, but to prescribe me anti-nausea medicine to take for the ibuprofen, which makes sense, right? It was like the Hippocratic Oath, you know, you can only fight medicine with medicine. But you know, that actually worked. And when I took them both, I managed the pain and the nausea, and I was fine, and I survived, and my wisdom teeth haven't grown back yet. And that is how I survived my first time under the knife. Thank you very much.
Twitter is very funny. Do you write these jokes specifically for Twitter? Mm-hmm. By the way, thank you for the tip about the card. I'm going to use that. I'm going to use that for the rest of my life.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
Can you explain that joke for the folks who didn't check out your Twitter feed? Because I think you're underappreciated. I really do. That Twitter feed is really funny.
So, you know, there's that awkward situation where someone at work had like maybe like a baby or is like very sick or had a great loss, and they start passing a card around for everyone to sign and write a little message. And you can never just sign it because you can't be the only person who just wrote your name and everybody else wrote a message. And it's so awkward because maybe you don't know the person, or maybe you don't know what to say to someone who just lost their dog of 19 years. I haven't experienced that. I'm not going to pretend to know.
What do you write?
So what you do is you read over what everybody else has already written. You find the best message. Maybe it's the funniest. Maybe it's the most touching. Maybe it's the most personal. You find the best message. And then you just look for space somewhere up and to the left of it, anywhere. And most people don't start there, which is nice. And then you just copy it. And you sign it your name. So they're going to read that card in order. And it's going to look like the other person copied you. Great stuff. You're the most touching. You're the funniest. You're the most personable. You win the card.
It's even funnier when you deliver the joke. Okay. So Barbara Holmes Night, are you a big fan?
Huge fan. Great. I would say most people in town say that's one of the best, if not the best, weekly show.
It really is. It's an electric atmosphere, and you've performed there before, right?
Mm-hmm. I actually just performed there this Monday, too, so I'm coming fresh from the experience. It's just a very warm room, not in the sense that in the sense that audiences laugh, because that's how they describe audiences that laugh a lot, but also, you know, Barbara says off the top, she's got a disclaimer, she said, you know, The little things that maybe comedy audiences don't know. She says, if you get up to go to the bar, no one here is going to make fun of you, which is why a lot of people don't sit in the front at comedy shows, because they think they're going to get made fun of, because a lot of comics do that.
That's true.
That's a classic thing. And also, she doesn't, I don't know if it's advertised, but it is a safe space room. So, you know, you're not going to hear any, like, cheap sexist, racist, transphobic, ableist, ageist, you know, right. Like, the classist. You're not going to hear that there. And if you didn't hear that, classification, you wouldn't know that it wouldn't sound like, oh, this kind of comedy, because it is still a wide variety of comics and perspectives and jokes and styles. But it's just
as a comic and as an audience member, it's nice to know that I'm not going to walk into a room where I'm going to hear somebody make fun of, you know, something that my parents do, or something that, you know, that like that I've struggled with, or something like that. And so much of comedy, for some people, it's escapist. You know, it's like, I had a really rough day. I've been reading the news all day. Like, right. I need to laugh. And if you need that, and then you go to a place and someone's just, you know, talking trash about something you think is important, or someone you find dear, or a part of you, it just, that can just make the day so much worse. So I think something magical about Barbara's Room is that you know you're going to leave it feeling good and uplifted afterward. And that's just a great expectation to have established in the scene. It's not that easy to do that.
Did you say magical? It's a magical night?
Yeah. I mean, they got jellyfish. They have both a fireplace and an aquarium within 3 feet of each other. Every time I see that, duality of life, you know, symbolic.
Now, we'd like to talk about your website. We need to get people to this thing to check out your material, your dates, your Twitter feed, your video, everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Where can we find out more about Katie?
It's katie-nguyen.com, katie-nguyen.com. And my brother made the website, so I'm extra excited to promo it because it's a little family affair there. And I've got, you know, bio. I've got contact information if you're interested in getting in touch. I've got videos, articles written about me. I've got upcoming dates. And the contact form isn't just if you want to book me. I also teach a class at Deep End Theater. So if you're interested in getting into stand-up at all, or if you just want to know more about the industry, I'm always happy to answer questions or to engage with people. There's a lot. It's kind of an insular thing. I feel like people who are in the comedy audience crew or as a comic, they know
true.
It.
That is true, yes.
People who don't go to shows know nothing about live comedy. They know the big stuff that they see on TV, but they don't. A lot of people, when they start doing comedy or they go to their first show, they're like, wow, when are their other shows? And you send them to, pdxcomedy.com, pdxstandup.com, and they see that, wow, there are multiple shows every single night of the week, pretty much every single day of the year, and it's just a very separate thing, so... anybody who has questions about going to shows or want to just talk about what it's like to be in comedy or what it's like to be a woman in comedy or a person of color in comedy, I have experience with that. And I've talked with a lot of people about that. And I love to engage and talk about these issues. Yeah.
Well, that's how I got in contact with you. I reached out. And thank you. I really appreciate, you know, what you've shared with us today. And yes, I think you're a very funny comic. And thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast at pdxpodcast.com. My name is Gregory Day. We will see you next week. Please join me. Do you read a lot? You just used the word eschewed. I would think so.
I am a language arts teacher, so yeah, I definitely read quite a bit.
Language arts teacher? Mm-hmm. I had no idea.
Yeah, nobody expects.
Do you ever talk about that?
Do I talk
about... Is that a source of material for you? I don't think I've heard you joke about that.
I've got one bit about how teenagers are at this point in life where they're starting to learn more about the world around them, but they still don't have the necessary life experience to understand it. So I have one bit about kind of where, because I work with teenagers, so I work at high school. I have one bit about it, but I don't know, it feels almost exploitative. You know, like
right.
People who like all their entire act is about their family, and sometimes it's in such an endearing and wonderful way. You're like, you just want to share this with us. And other times they're just like talking mess, and you're like, this is therapy for you. So I think, you know, the stuff with kids, the thing is, they say they're the funniest people I've ever met. They're funnier than like most of the comics I've met. They're just
like, how old are they?
14 to 18.
Wow.
Yeah, so they're hilarious and they don't even know it. That's what's funny about it. What's funny is what they don't understand.
They're funny because they're honest.
Yeah, and they're at the stage in life where it's still acceptable for them to learn and fail and grow and not know things. So there's just a different dynamic with people who are in that position where they're still given permission to not know things and ask questions, whereas a lot of adults will, you know, feign understanding and just kind of muddle through it, and that's what we're used to when we talk to other people.
That's funny. That's all I do is ask questions. By the way, hello.
Yeah, hello, hello.
We just started, like, we're in the middle of an interview there.
I didn't know if that was a sound check.
Nice to meet you.